Yeah, thanks a lot, Mads, for the introduction. So as said, I will keep on continuing with talking about this recent hype of transformer models. So let me start with quickly reviewing why we are motivated to look into these transformer models. And I guess I'm not telling you anything new here, but yeah, transformer models are commonly used in natural language processing. And I guess all of you have experienced the recent powers of transformers in different applications. For example, the DeepL translator, as well as Google Translate, are based on transformers and do a really impressive job in translating text from any language into any other language. Grammarly is another really nice example, which can take some text and can summarize it, it can reformulate it, can find all the spelling errors, and so on. So this is really impressive. And of course, our good friend that we all got pretty familiar with over the last months, ChatGPT is of course based on a transformer, as the name already suggests. And I assume every one of you has at least played around with it, maybe even made some good use of it or of these tools. And I think at some point we all had this moment when we realized how impressive and powerful these models are and what they can do. And that we can really go beyond everything that was possible before these transformer models were developed. And the reason why transformers are so good at natural language processing is basically that they are really good at capturing long-range correlations in a sequence. Meaning that if we look at our language models, our sequence is just a sequence of words. And now you know in the language, we always have some correlations between words that appear somewhere in the beginning of a sentence or a text and somewhere pretty far away at the other end of the text. And transformers perform really well at capturing these long-range correlations in the sequence. And this lets them go beyond any other neural network models like recurrent neural networks that were previously used for such sequential data. Another example, just to show you that transformers are not only used in language processing, they are also used in image generation and image processing. So I think we all played around with DALL-E at some point. So you can give it some description and it generates an image for you. You can also give it some image and it draws an image around this, which is pretty impressive. So I wouldn't have guessed that this was generated by an AI. We can also give it some image and tell it what to do with the image, so it adds some flamingo or something here. So again, this is really impressive. And it's based on the same principles. So now instead of having a sequence of words, we have a sequence of pixels, but still we have strong correlations between the pixels in the lower left corner of the image and the upper right corner of the image. And the transformer is able to capture all these correlations. And this is the main power of the transformer. And now you can imagine if we think about quantum many-body physics, well, if we want to study them numerically or simulate them, we often run into these limitations that we are not able to capture long-range correlations in the systems with the numerical methods we use. And this is why people get excited about transformers, and people wanted to explore if transformers can also, in quantum many-body physics, help with capturing these long-range correlations. And we have already seen during this conference that there are quite some works about using transformers in the field of quantum many-body physics. Una has talked about this work together with Juan, where they use transformers for quantum state tomography. There's very recently another work also about using transformers for quantum state tomography, so basically reconstructing density matrices or wave functions from measurement data. Other examples are here on the right, which is also pretty remarkable. It's about Hamiltonian learning with transformers, or also generalization. So basically what they do here in these plots, they trained the model on some part of the phase diagram. So they chose the Hamiltonian parameter H here, trained the model on some part of it, and then they were able to generalize and really simulate regimes that the transformer was not trained on. And again, this worked really well. And yeah, another example is variational Monte Carlo. And this is also what I will talk about more today. People use transformer models to numerically find ground states of a given Hamiltonian. And the interesting thing is, so this work is, I think, 2 years old. The other works all appeared within the last couple of months. So this is a very recent topic that people are getting excited about. And all these results show us that transformers are really useful in quantum many-body physics. And so together with my former student, Kyle Sprague, we were wondering how good are these transformer really? like, what can we gain if we use transformers? And so we specifically used at this variation Monte Carlo example, where we took some Hamiltonian of a qubit system, and we chose the transformer as a wave function answer, and we wanted to find the ground state of this Hamiltonian. And the way this is commonly done quite a lot, we have seen this yesterday in Mohammed's talk, is using recurrent neural networks as a wave function ansatz. And Mohammed has shown us that this works really well, but he has also talked about the limitations of covering long-range correlations in the system. Mohammed then went to two-dimensional RNNs to deal with these correlations between elements that are far apart in the sequence, but not necessarily in the qubit system. And here we will, instead of going to 2D RNNs, we will look at the transformers. So we were wondering, can transformers do better since they are known for being able to deal with long-range correlations? And the main difference between the RNN and the transformer, which makes the transformer able to deal with long-range correlations, is that it does not have this recurrent behavior, as we have seen it yesterday, but instead it has this so-called self-attention layer. And I will go into a little more detail, or I will at least try to go into a little more detail on this. And this attention layer really allows us to capture correlations between all sequence elements. So let me start with quickly summarizing again how these recurrent neural network quantum states work. The nice thing about giving the talk at the end of the week is that all the concepts have already been introduced, so I can keep it pretty short. But just as a reminder, so we have our recurrent neural network. We have the RNN cell, which consists of hidden units and some variation parameters. And then at each iteration of the RNN cell, we send in the state of one qubit in our system. And we also send in the hidden unit configuration of the previous RNN iteration. We apply a softmax function to the output, which gives us a probability over the state of the next qubit in the sequence. And from this, we can sample the state of the next qubit. And then we use this state as the next input in the next iteration and so on. So Mohammed has shown it nicely. So we basically snake through our qubit system sequentially. And with this, we get a sample for the configuration of each qubit in the system. Now, since we propagate this hidden unit configuration from one iteration to the other, we generate kind of a memory effect. So we have some information in our system about the states of previous elements in the sequence. And due to this, our output probability is not just a probability, but it's a probability conditioned on the states of all previous elements in the sequence. And so this way, we are kind of able to capture correlations between the qubits, but we have to encode all the information in these hidden unit configurations, which limits the amount of correlation we can capture. Okay, and then we can interpret these output probabilities as the squared wave function amplitude, as Mohammed has shown. So basically, we take the product over all conditional probabilities in our sequence. We interpret it as a squared wave function amplitude, and we train our network by tuning these variation parameters to reconstruct a target wave function amplitude. And once we have trained our network, we can generate more samples of our qubit configurations, which basically correspond to the outcome of projective measurements. And we can use these samples to evaluate expectation values of observables. So for example, the energy expectation value, which we then directly use to train our network. So basically what we do is we evaluate the energy expectation value using samples from our network. So we approximate it with this. And then we train our network parameters such that we minimize this energy expectation value of a given Hamiltonian, which drives us towards the ground state. And just as a quick side note, so throughout all this work, we were using just a gradient descent approach. So no stochastic reconfiguration or anything, but really just a standard gradient descent. Okay, so this is how we can reconstruct our quantum states with recurrent neural networks and how we can find ground states. Now, if we want to do the same thing with transformers, it's actually not that much of a difference. We still have our sequential setup or our regressive behavior. We use one qubit after the other. We use it as an input. We get, as an output of the transformer, some signal where we apply a softmax activation function. We can interpret the outcome as a probability for the next qubit, and we sample the next qubit state, which we use as an input in the next iteration, and so on. So we basically use the same behavior as for the recurrent neural networks, but now our recurrent neural network cell has been replaced with this transformer. And I don't really have the time to go into the details of all the elements in the transformer. So let me just mention the main points. So I already talked about this self-attention layer. So this is now very different than in the recurrent neural network, where we were propagating the hidden unit configuration. Now we have this one layer, which gets as an input, basically the signals of all elements in the sequence. And so here we have trained connections to all previous elements in the sequence, which means we have direct access, and we don't encode our information in a hidden unit configuration or something, but we can directly access each element in the sequence with trained network weights, which gives us directly the ability to highlight important elements in the sequence. We here use a so-called mask self-attention layer, which basically means we apply a mask so that this qubit does not get any information from this qubit. Right, so we only want to look at elements which appeared previously in the sequence, because these are the ones that we have already sampled, while everything that happens afterwards has not been determined yet. And so we apply a mask just telling us, okay, don't look at all these or everything that is coming later in the sequence. Another important thing is this positional encoding. So now we don't have a recurrent behavior here. So we just put in a sequence, and by default, we don't have any information about the ordering of the sequence elements. And so we have to apply some positional encoding, which basically adds a matrix to our input signals, and with this gives each element an individual factor, which in the end gives us some information about where exactly this element can be found in the sequence. So we still keep track of the sequence ordering. For those people who are kind of familiar with the transformer, we just use the standard positional encoding as proposed in the original paper. But again, I don't have time to go into details here. So just remember that this positional encoding is necessary to keep the order of the sequence. And now we can use the same approach as in the RNN. So we can define this probability over all our qubit states by just taking the product of all conditional probabilities. And we can train our network to approximate the squared wave function amplitude. So again, same approach as in RNNs. We just replaced the RNN cell with this transformer. And this is everything we did now. So now we wanted to compare the two models. So we wanted to see how do RNNs, or recurrent neural networks, compare to transformers when we want to find ground states of a given Hamiltonian. And the main differences, just to summarize, is that for the recurrent neural network, information is encoded in the hidden state, which gives us a limited amount of memory. While in the transformer, we have, through the attention mechanism, we have direct access to the entire sequence. And so the basic question for our work is, how does this attention feature affect the representation of quantum states? And now all this can be applied to any arbitrary system of qubits, and we somehow need to fix or need to focus on one system just to be able to compare the two. And so we looked at the Rydberg atom arrays. And now, gratefully, Anna Kröner has introduced these in a lot of detail. So I can keep it rather short. So to just quickly recap, we have our neutral atoms, which can be prepared in some ground state and some highly excited state. Can arrange them on a lattice, and we here just always look at two-dimensional square lattices. And then we can perform projective measurements, which basically tell us for each atom whether it is in the ground or in the excited state. Then the system is described by the Rydberg Hamiltonian. So we have two terms which affect each atom individually, generated by some external laser driving. So we have the detuning term, which basically detunes the excited energy level. And we have a Rabi oscillation between the two states with frequency omega. And this last term generates van der Waals interactions between any pair of atoms. So if we think about our atoms being in the ground or in the excited state, and we know that it is a highly excited state, we know that the electrons are found on very large orbitals, which means they generate van der Waals interactions with the atoms around it. And with this, any other excitation within a certain radius, which is the Rydberg blockade radius, gets penalized. So this is also illustrated here. You see this atom is in the excited state, and so everything in this within this Rydberg blockade radius stays in the ground state. And then Anna has also nicely discussed that there are theoretical or numerical simulations of these systems, which have shown us that there exist a huge variety of different phases we can find the system in, separated by different kinds of phase transitions. And these systems are not only theoretically of great interest, but also experimentally, they are really accessible. Again, Anna has shown us some other experimental results. But people can really accurately arrange these atoms on different kind of lattices, in 2D, in 3D, in whatever. And they can really represent or can prepare the atoms in these different phases here. And so this is why people are really excited about these Rydberg atom arrays. They are really promising candidates for high accuracy quantum computation and quantum simulation. And so we wanted to use these systems as a benchmarking model for our recurrent neural networks and transformers. Another nice thing about Rydberg, or generally about the Rydberg Hamiltonian, is that it is stochastic, which basically gives us the property that all ground states of this Hamiltonian are positive and real valued. So the same way as Mohammed did it yesterday, we don't really need to care about complex phases in our simulations. If we only want to find ground states, we only need to look at the squared wave function amplitudes, which makes our neural network ansatz much easier. Okay, so let's take a look at how all this works. So here we are now looking at one point in the phase diagram. So we fix our Hamiltonian parameters just to some values. I think it drives us pretty close to the transition between the disordered and the striated phase. And then we trained the RNN in blue and the transformer in orange on different system sizes. So we have 8x8 atoms, 16x16 atoms. And during the training process, we looked at the evolution of the energy difference between our energy expectation value evaluated on neural network samples and some energy that we get from QMC simulations that EHS has written, which we kind of treat as the exact energy. And so this is the absolute difference plotted here as a function of the training iterations. The black dashed line is the uncertainty in the QMC simulations. And we see that, so for 8x8, both models converge pretty nicely, but the transformer converges much, much faster than the RNN. If we go to larger systems, the RNN, up to 20,000 training iterations, it doesn't really converge to the ground state yet, but the transformer does. And what is also interesting is that these dots that, or these data points that have the black edge, they go below the QMC energy, but they always stay within the uncertainty. So we are not violating the variation in principle here, we are just below the QMC energy, which kind of suggests that we are more accurate, but at the same time, we are also fluctuating still a lot here. So this looks all really nice, and it basically suggests what we expected. Transformers outperform the RNNs, they converge faster and better for larger system sizes. But of course, this all doesn't come for free. So if we look at the computational runtimes, so now I'm writing down tau here. Tau is the total runtime for 20,000 training iterations. For the RNN, for 8x8, it takes 1.5 hours. The transformer already takes 9.5 hours. If we go to larger system sizes, the RNN, 16 hours is still pretty much okay. The transformer takes almost a week. Okay, and so with this, we cannot really go to larger system sizes because you don't want to run your simulation for more than a week. This is pretty much also where our cluster cuts off. So,
I have a question about that, sure. Though. But doesn't your data show that you could also have stopped the simulation earlier?
Exactly. So, right, especially for the transformer, we could have stopped at like 10,000 iterations, but still, I mean, it would cut down the runtime by a factor of two. We can go a bit larger, but it's not really useful still, yeah. So these results are really nice and really exciting, but they also show us that, transformers are good, but they are extremely expensive. And so we thought about how we can speed things up, how we can make our computations more efficient. And here we took some inspiration from the vision transformer. And I told you earlier, transformers can be applied to image data. And then now you can imagine if you compare image data with like language processing data, the length of the sequence that we put into the transformer is much longer. And it's really long. We have a huge amount of pixels, which gives us a really long sequence or input sequence to the transformer. And this leads to really long computation times. And so these people in this work, they came up with the vision transformer, which basically divides our image into smaller patches, and then instead of sending in one pixel after the other, they send in a patch of pixels, one patch after the other, And with this, they reduce the sequence length by a factor of the patch size. And this makes everything much faster, so we have a very much shorter sequence length, and with this also a much shorter computation time. And now this is applied for image processing, but apparently our qubit system is pretty similar. And people have already found this connection. So in these two works, which appeared just during the last months, they looked at representing qubit states with the transformer model. And you can see, I think they don't really talk a lot about it. But if you look at the figures, you see they also send in patches of 3 qubits at a time, and with this make things faster. Looking at the work Mohammed was talking about yesterday, he did pretty much the same thing for the RNN. So he was sending in patches of qubits in the Kagome lattice instead of sending in each qubit individually. There exist works where people send in patches of qubits instead of single qubits to represent these states. And so we said, well, we can do exactly the same thing. So we introduced, chose this patch neural network approach, where instead of looking at one qubit or one atom after the other, we now look at patches of 2x2 atoms, one at a time. And so our input now is 2x2 atoms. Then we have either our RNN cell or the transformer. We can apply it to both networks. It doesn't make much of a difference. And then we again apply a softmax function to the output. And now our output probability is over all possible states of the patch of qubits. So our output probability now is defined over 16 states because we have 4 input atoms. And from this, we sample the state of the next patch in the system, right? So we iteratively now go over the patches instead of over the individual qubits. And this divides our sequence length by a factor of 4 because we have 2x2 patches. And of course, this makes the computations much faster, but we also expect that local correlations are better captured just because they are directly encoded in this probability distribution where we sample from. So that's what we expect. Let's take a look at how it performs. So we look at the same point in the phase diagram as we did before, same Hamiltonian parameters. This is the same data as 2 slides earlier. And now down here, we use the patch recurrent neural network and the patch transformer with 2x2 input patches. And what we see is, well, the convergence gets much better already for the RNN. If we compare the green one with the blue one up here, it converges much, much faster. And especially if we look at larger system sizes, the patched RNN now does converge to the ground state energy. And you see for the patch transformer, it has really small variations, and they are all below the QMC energy. So we definitely get a higher accuracy for the energy expectation value than QMC does here. And also the transformer converges much faster than for the non-patched case. So again, this is really promising. And now we look at 2x2 patches. So if 2x2 patches are really good, can we go to larger patches? And so, yeah, we have experienced significant speedups and higher accuracies as we expected. What happens if we go to larger patches? So it should get even better, it should get even faster, and give us even more opportunities. But the big problem is, as I mentioned, our output dimension scales exponentially with the input patch size. Right, so this is always defined over all possible configurations of the patch, which is 2 to the number of atoms in the patch. And so this basically limits us to 2x2 patches because we have to evaluate these probabilities for each individual state, and we cannot do this if our output gets too large. And then Kyle was, he had a really great inspiration. He came up with the large patch transformers. And so instead of just looking at or taking the output of the transformer and directly calculating the probability distribution, what he did is he took the output of the transformer and used it as an initial hidden configuration of an RNN. And this RNN now breaks down our system. So we send in a patch of, let's say, 4x4 atoms, and the RNN breaks it down in these smaller patches of 2x2 atoms. And so this works exactly the same way as if we just apply only the RNN, because now we just look at a smaller system size, basically, and we break it down into 2x2 patches. And this makes everything faster, so our output dimension is fixed to 16 elements over which we evaluate the probability distribution, but we can send an arbitrarily large patch size here. And generally, this is just the setup we chose. You can also have a recurrent neural network at the bottom, a transformer at the top. You can have two transformers, two recurrent neural networks. So you can play around with this. The reason why we chose this setup is basically that we wanted to make use of the extreme powers of the transformer when we look at, at the large patches. And then when we go to smaller patches, we know that the RNN still works really well on small system sizes, and it's way more efficient. So we can make use of the efficiency if we just apply the RNN on top. And so this is our large patch transformer. And again, let's take a look at how it performs if we still look at the same Hamiltonian parameters as before. So again, all this data is what we have seen earlier. The new data is now this purple curve here, and purple and brown here, where we use the large patch transformer. And we use input patches of 4x4 and 8x8 atoms, while the sub-patch, so basically the patch size of the RNN, is still 2x2. And what we find is where convergence is slower than if we have only the 2x2 patches. But at the same time, if we look at the run times, they are much faster. So we don't care if we have to run more training iterations if the overall runtime is still faster than if we use the smaller patches. And looking at the overall runtime, it's really remarkable. So with our large patch transformer, we were able to go down to 4.5 hours compared to 144 hours that we started with using the transformer model on the single qubits. And looking at the accuracy, it's still pretty impressive. So it hasn't really changed when we went to the large patch transformer. So the only thing we got out of here is an immense speed up in our computations. And so this was a really impressive result. We have shown that, yeah, we can get higher accuracies, and we can actually get really high accuracies at very short computation times. So we now end up with reasonable runtimes and high accuracies in finding the ground state of the RIPPAC system. So this was, again, so far so good. But we only looked at one point in the phase diagram. We looked at models with up to 16 by 16 atoms. What happens if we go larger and we scale things up? And so what we did now, we still stayed at the same point in the phase diagram. We still wanted to find the ground state. But now we started with scaling the patch size. And you can see we also look at rectangular shaped patches. And we also started to scale the system size. And you can see here we went up to 40 by 40 atoms, which is pretty huge. I think it is beyond everything I could find in the recent literature. So these are really massive systems. And we again look at the energy difference compared to QMC, where we now, I think we average over training iterations 19,000 to 20,000 or something like this. So this is already when the network is trained. What we find is that if we make our patch too large, then the accuracy gets worse, which kind of makes sense because we still have this small RNN on top, which only has 2x2 patches. So I think the representational power of the RNN is limiting us here when we go to larger patch sizes. But also we have an increased amount of information which is captured in the patch that we send in, which we need to kind of recover when we, or that we need to recover in our neural network. And so it gets more difficult if our patches get too large. But then at the same time, if we stay at around 8x8 atoms in our patch, then, or even smaller, then this works really well. We are below the QMC in accuracies. So we are again outperforming QMC here. So let's take a look at the runtimes. So we also evaluated the computational runtime for a single training iteration now as a function of these patch sizes. And what you see is that in the beginning, well, they do decrease when we increase the patch size. So this is kind of expected. At some point, they converge and they saturate, which is mainly due to the fact that we had to change our implementation a little bit because you need more memory if you have larger patches. So we kind of had to break it down to reduce the amount of memory that we were using. And this led to slightly increased runtimes. But still, if we look at patches of 8x8 and smaller, our runtime is pretty short, and we can significantly reduce it compared to our initial transformer models. What is also interesting is that we don't really see a difference between rectangular or square-shaped patches. So the form of the patch doesn't really matter. What matters is really the size of the patch and how many atoms are in there. Okay, and so as a conclusion, choosing patches around 8x8 atoms, we can model enormous system sizes at reasonable computational costs, but with still really high accuracies. Okay, and so as a last example, we also looked at what happens if we go to different points in the phase diagram. And so we looked at the transition between the disordered phase. So basically, we fixed our Hamiltonian parameters. So we fixed omega and we fixed the interaction. And we were tuning delta over the transition between the disordered phase, which we find for small delta, and this checkerboard phase, which we find for large delta. And now here we are looking at the staggered magnetization, which Anna, I think, has introduced also briefly. It's the definition of the staggered magnetization. It's basically the order parameter of the checkerboard phase. So here we see that we definitely end up in the checkerboard phase because our order parameter increases here. And we evaluate our staggered magnetization on using QMC simulations and using the large patch transformer, where we look at 8x8 atoms with patches of 4x4, so input patches of 4x4 atoms. And we look at 16x16 atoms using input patches of 8x8 atoms. And what you basically see is they all perfectly overlap with the QMC simulations. What is interesting is that right around the phase transition, the QMC has large errors, which is, I think it's mainly caused by the fact that we have correlations between the QMC samples. These don't really appear in our LPDF simulations. So our large patch transformer is really accurate at any point in the phase diagram that we looked at. And so the inset is just showing the difference between our transformer and the QMC. And you see, okay, the difference between the two is the largest around the phase transition, but it's still pretty small. So it's still really accurate what we get out of here. And so, again, we have shown that we can reach high accuracies in both phases and even at the phase transition directly, which is also pretty remarkable. And yeah, this brings me to my summary. So we have shown that if we consider patches of atoms, or generally of qubits, instead of single qubits in our sequential networks, we can reach higher accuracies and shorter runtimes. And if we combine our transformer with the RNN, then we reach this setup of the large patch transformer, which goes beyond any state-of-the-art simulation results that you find in the literature these days. And we have applied it to Rydberg systems. Generally, you can apply this approach to any kind of qubit system on probably any kind of lattice and so on. So it should be pretty flexible, but I haven't tried it on anything else yet. But just another remark, the chosen transformer models that we use here. So we only used the encoder model. We did not use a decoder. We didn't need it. But they are extremely small compared to what is used in language processing. So I think we heard some numbers about parameters yesterday. We use something like 1.2 million parameters, which is really a very small amount. It sounds like a lot, but it's a very small amount of parameters. So we have a lot of opportunities here to still scale up our transformer and with this get access to even more complex qubit systems. And yeah, with this, I'm at the end of my presentation. I thank you a lot for your attention. I'm happy to take questions.
Yeah, thank you very much, Steph, for that cool talk. You already mentioned on that last slide that you could do different lattices with this. Could you explain a little bit what would need to be modified, if anything at all?
I mean, it only affects the Hamiltonian, basically, right? So we don't have any information about how far apart the atoms are from each other, except for the interaction term in the Hamiltonian. So yeah, you basically wouldn't need to change anything except for your Hamiltonian parameters.
Okay, you just need to change the IJ.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Thanks for a really cool talk. I don't have a ton of experience with neural nets, but I was able to follow it, so fun. I wanted to ask about your data. So when you were comparing all of the convergence times, for most of your runs, you had many more training cycles than it seemed like you needed. Crossed.
Mm-hmm.
And then you provided those runtime taus. Are those taus just for the full number of cycles in the plot, the amount of time that the...
Yeah. Yeah, so they were always for 20,000 iterations, yeah.
Okay, so then my question is, have you compared, like assuming you put like a stop into your algorithm for as soon as it crosses that line, you compared that completion time to the different
models? No, so we didn't compare this because I found it like kind of an unfair comparison if you take into account when your model has converged. So I just wanted to look at the absolute computation time. Hmm. And it's hard to define when your model has converged. Like you barely know when it is converged. So for us, it was easier to just really look at total amount of iterations. All models get the same amount. How do they compare?
Thank you.
Thank you for a great talk. My question is, could you just please restate why? I'm still quite fuzzy about what's the benefit of using an RNN on top of a transformer? As to what does this gain you practically?
You mean like, so what? Why do we put it at all, or why do we not put another transformer?
Why not just like call the output of the transformer some hidden state that you can then project onto a probability type of thing that you can
So basically because your probability, your output probability scales exponentially with the patch size. So if you go to larger patches, you don't want to calculate the probability for all possible states. Right? So it's a softmax function, which means you have to evaluate it on each possible outcome. You cannot do this if your outcome scales exponentially with the patch size. And so we use this RNN to basically cut it down to 2x2 patches again. And then your output is still just of dimension 16.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Hi, very interesting. I have one question more concerned about the physics in this model. So you have shown that it compares well to quantum Monte Carlo in a certain regime of the phase diagram, namely where you have the transition between the disordered phase and the charge density wave in that model. But you can also have more fancy phases. And where actually the physics is not yet clear, and there are different predictions, in particular for the transition between the disordered and the striated phase, mm-hmm. where there are indications either first order or second order. Have you tried to apply your method also to that phase to maybe resolve that question?
Yeah, no. So this was the kind of the initial work where we just wanted to see how it performs at all. But yeah, it's definitely on the list to explore more interesting physics with it. Yeah.
As in, my question is in regards to this nesting of sequential models, essentially. Would you think that the natural extension of this would be to create a tree transformer, basically, mm-hmm. that has a nested structure?
Yeah, so that's one thing we thought about. So especially as we realized when we have two large patches, then the performance gets worse. So I think you could do something like a tree or a pyramid where you kind of have one model after the other and you kind of sequentially decrease the patch size until you reach a size where you can deal with the output dimension. Yeah, I haven't tried it out yet, but I could imagine that it works. Yeah.
Very nice talk. Thank you. I was wondering about the symmetry Brocken phase. So when we've done calculations with the RNN, we find that the RNN does not break the symmetry, that you see the two symmetrized configurations. And I was wondering if you see the same, like, do you break or do not break the symmetry?
It's a great question. I think we never looked at the data in that detail.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry. So the nice thing about RNN sometimes is that that hidden state can be interpreted. And I noticed in your training curves for the RNN, it has a bunch of jumps. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if those are like learning rate updates, or are they actually things that you can interpret and say, here I see it learns this feature of the data and then that feature.
Yeah, no. So this is something we observed in previous works as well. So somehow when you train the RNN, you often have these jumps. I don't think they have anything to do with the learning rate. So I had one student looking into it, and what they basically found is that at these jumps, the long-range correlations are captured better. I don't know why it happened so suddenly, but it's what you would also expect, that like you build up the short-range correlations, and then later on during the training, you get the long-range correlations between the atoms. But yeah, I really have no intuition why it really jumps down suddenly.
Very interesting. Yeah, thanks.
Isn't that called grokking in
machine
learning?
I've heard that before, but yeah.
I think it's an unexplained phenomenon in general.
But
But you say it does do, it does go like from like larger, like longer and longer range correlations.
Yeah, there yeah. Is, so we could definitely, we could directly see the jumps in the long range correlation. So you could see, okay, they are not captured that well yet. And then suddenly, right. like you could right. see another order of correlations here.
Yeah, interesting, thanks.
I had a kind of related question, which is just like if you, if your goal is to stay at a fixed system size here and then just like really push, keep pushing the accuracy down and down and down, because you're already getting like really, you know, what would be the main thing to do? Is it like bit like more expressive models, or is it like more training time, or do you know what's like, what would be like the first thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, yeah, getting more expressive models usually comes with more computing time. Yeah, I'm really not sure about that.
Thanks for an amazing talk. I am wondering the following. Like, so you explained super nice how like making smaller batches makes your model more expressive, and then your RNN cannot keep up when you make a bigger batches. But then from a physics point of view, I would think that chopping it up into the patches, you somehow inevitably factorize your underlying probability distribution, even if you have this like a recurrent feature. So from a physics, I would want exactly the opposite thing, that the patch is as big as possible. So looking going forward with this research, how do you think about optimizing these two competing things?
I think my naive approach would be what Yihang suggested, that you kind of successively break down the patch size instead of going from 16 by 16 to 2 by 2, right? So you go from 16 by 16 to 8 by 8 to 4 by 4 to 2 by 2, and then I think you should get higher accuracies. Yes, it's really a matter of how you deal with the large patch size. Or maybe it would also just help if you, instead of using the RNN up here, you put another transformer, which can deal better with larger patches. So maybe this already changes it a lot. But yeah, it's a great question.
Okay, I'd say time for like one more question. So,
but isn't it the opposite? I thought that without patches you take single spins, and then it's like, I mean, I imagine kernel size one by one, and then you increase. So actually, larger patches is like more information at once. The transformer. I mean, at least in my head, it's opposite. I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Okay, well, let's thank Steph again. Really nice talk.